Welcome to Cinema Chop Shop. Watch, chop, retrofit.
All right, welcome to Cinema Chop Shop. This is a movie podcast that concedes that remakes are going to happen, so why shouldn't movie buffs like us decide who is recast in those iconic roles? You can find us online. We're on Twitter. We are at Cinema Chop Shop. We are also on Facebook. It's facebook.com/cinemachopshop. And then also our Gmail address, our email Gmail, is the cinemachopshop@gmail.com. Send us any suggestions, things like that. Also, if you like the beers that we check in here on the show, we check those in on untapped.com. That's untapped with two P's and no E. My name is Travis, and I will be your host, as well as your spirit guide on the trip that we're about to take. And I'm joined here, as always, in the shop by our engineer, editor, producer, extraordinaire, the birthday boy.
Woo!
The Canadian in your brain again is Andrew Tay.
I'm just going to adjust this microphone because I believe it's backwards.
Facing the wrong way.
And
do we need to start over?
No.
Start it from the top.
All right,
from the top. Welcome to Cinema Chop Shop. We are also extremely excited on Andrew's birthday to have two returning guests. Regular guest, my occasional co-host, Sean the Rabble Rouser. He's here in the shop to stir up some subversiveness.
Trippy vibes, man.
It's all about the energy, bro. And then also, fan favorite, our beat poet tonight, Joey Poole.
I'm going to introduce myself with a quote from one of the films, and that's, it's very unhip to say that you're hip.
Exactly. That was so good. There were certain parts of one of the movies that seemed very cliche, but we also have to keep in mind that it was of the time, right?
And a comedy.
What else we got? Oh, further description of the show. The tagline at the top says, watch, chop, retrofit, because essentially that is what we do here. We watch older movies. Sometimes they're classic films, sometimes not so much. We might have a couple of stinkers on our hands on this one.
One more than the other.
Yeah, right? One more so, for sure. And then we take those films and we retrofit them. What I mean by that is we tweak the design with new parts, a.k.a. Contemporary actors. Actors who are at the height of their powers.
Drink.
We're not drinking yet. I got a soda water, though.
That's for the listeners at home.
Indeed, and on that note, Sean has a quote from fellow podcaster. He's pretty much a peer of ours.
Yeah, totally a peer. Yeah.
Dan Harmon on Harmontown said something very poignant about this subject.
Yeah, this week he was on a free-form rap, as he's wont to do. He started out with Star Wars, then he jumped into Star Trek, and he ended with Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049.
Uh-huh.
And his point was he didn't like Blade Runner, which is fine. He's entitled to that opinion. But he did say something after that that I thought was really relevant to our show.
Uh-huh.
He said, if you make a movie based on a movie you liked, you run the risk of making a Xerox of a phantom of a thought.
Yes.
I understand the emotional concern. You were terrified that they were going to fuck up Blade Runner. The same way they fucked up RoboCop, the same way they fucked up many others.
Mm-hmm.
We've gotten so scared that they'll fuck everything up, you're relieved it wasn't fucked up. But not fucked up doesn't mean good.
Oh, yeah.
You don't want your Lyft driver to be, quote, not fucked up. You want him to be a good driver.
That's very good.
And so I thought that was a great point about, you know, the things that we are always saying about mm-hmm. the remake and reboot culture.
Uh-huh.
A lot of times these people will go in and say, well, it was pretty good. No, it wasn't.
Right.
It was terrible.
It just didn't meet your lowest expectations.
Right. You're just glad they didn't screw it up.
Or it met your lowest bar.
So I thought that was a
neat, I like
little,
that. Yeah. Very harsh but concise words about the current culture of cinema.
And Dan, if you're listening, which we know you are.
We appreciate any feedback. You can
and
hit us up on Twitter.
Yeah.
Put us on your network, man.
Yeah.
That would be, it would be a whole lot cooler if you did. Tonight, the energy drink check-in that we're going to do, like true hippies, I forgot to get an energy drink. So we're going to make our own. We're going to make our own energy drink tonight. And what we're going to do is we're going to have some La Croix, or La Croix, or as Hillary says, Las Croix, or something like that. And then we're going to add Some pure cocaine.
Awesome.
No, it's called Mio Energy. It's got caffeine and B vitamins. So you guys got your cups ready?
Sure.
The two energy drinks, excuse me, the two soda water flavors that we have are cran raspberry, and then also just the very nondescript berry flavor. So I need to go ahead and add a little bit. You go boom, 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 boom. One for each person. Boom, 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 boom. Very good. Now pour your own, gentlemen. All right. And now while we taste that and assess them for flavor and accuracy as an energy drink, I'm going to go ahead and talk about the very brief Department of Corrections department. And there's only one, and it's not even really a correction. It's just that something I forgot to talk about on the last episode. It is that during the discussion on Valley Girl, I forgot to bring up that Steve, Julie Richmond's dad, Steve, is played by a guy named Frederick Forrest, who the whole time I was watching that movie, I was like, who is this guy? I recognize him. Who is he? And then, you know, doing research for the show, I stumbled across where I knew him from, and it's Lonesome Dove, the TV miniseries. He played fucking Blue Duck. He was Blue Duck in Lonesome Dove, right? He's the one with the famous line, "Let's gamble. I haven't had a game in a while."
Oh, you know who else he is?
Who else is he?
He is the neo-Nazi owner of the pawn shop in
Falling Down. Wow. So, quick shout out to Frederick Forrest. As we know, you are listening as well. Sorry for leaving you out of the last episode. Also, we meant to talk about the analogy with Wicker Man. Wicker Man, the original, is considered a horror classic, a seminal film in the horror genre. Some people have equated it to the Citizen Kane of that genre. And then the remake with Nicolas Cage
is a reason why you should not remake movies.
Right. Yeah. It's, some people say it's the worst best movie, which is a description that has also been applied to another movie that's about to be re-released, The Room, the Tommy Wiseau movie. So the analogy is, original Wicker Man is to Citizen Kane as Nicolas Cage Wicker Man is to The Room. So, enough said. That will close the door on the Department of Corrections department. Very good. All right, so next up, we've got a little bit about the theme of this episode. We've made a few references to it so far. And if you didn't figure it out yet, the theme of the episode is counterculture movies. And of course, by that, I mean films that are thematically related to people who renovate their kitchen.
Yeah, counterculture. Yeah.
Right? So they get the tile in there and the grout.
I like those slate counters.
Yeah. No?
So nice.
That's not what we're talking about. Shit, all of my research is wrong. No, it's about lunch counters in New York City.
Well, there's a tie-in there.
There is lunch a tie-in. Yes, yeah. Yes. Lunch counter sit-ins, which we will talk about in a little bit. Really, what we're talking about are counterculture films, which are films that relate to the counterculture movement. And specifically, the reason that we're doing this weekend is because this coming Sunday, or probably the day that this episode comes out, is the 51st anniversary of the first, I guess only, human be-in. It's in quotes, the human be-in, hyphenated on the B and the in. It took place in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, and it launched the Summer of Love, and really was kind of the cornerstone, the first breaking ground of the counterculture movement. Now, there obviously was some things that led up to that, but the human being took place in the polo fields of Golden Gate Park and led to Haight Ashbury being a symbol of American counterculture. It focused on the key ideas of 1960s counterculture, including personal empowerment. That's good. Cultural and political decentralization. I think we could use some of that. Communal living. Doesn't always work out so well. Ecological awareness. We need that. Higher consciousness. I'm on board. Then in parentheses, with the aid of psychedelic drugs. Red flag. Acceptance of illicit psychedelic use. Oh, And then radical liberal political consciousness. So this is really about conservatism versus liberalism and changing of ideologies and new thoughts that came out of both the Beat Generation and the human rights movement, the civil rights movement, rather.
All culminating in that.
Right. So specifically the lunch counter sit-ins in Greensboro, mm-hmm. North Carolina, and I think there was also some in Kentucky. At the same time, the Beat Generation, Allen Ginsberg, was happening, and they say that Allen Ginsberg kind of represents the transition from Beat culture to hippie culture or the counterculture movement. Any thoughts on that?
I'm going to save mine until we discuss the two films.
Okay. The name, they took it from a chance remark by an artist named Michael Bowen, and he made it at the Love Pageant Rally. He used the phrase, human being, right?
Yeah, man, I get it.
And the playful name combined humanist values with the scores of sit-ins that had been reforming college and university practices and eroding vestiges of entrenched segregation and also... establishmentarian values and conservatism in general. All right, so are we ready for the Midnight Double Feature? You guys are ready? All right, I've got mine. Who wants to go first?
Doesn't matter to me. I'm almost afraid mine will get taken because it's low-hanging
fruit. Well, then go for it.
I picked two films that star... Peter Fonda.
Okay.
And Dennis Hopper.
Oh, okay. So I know one of them off the top of my head.
Well, sure. The one that is everyone's go-to for counterculture would be Easy Rider.
Uh-huh. With Jack Nicholson.
That's probably the film document of the,
yes.
of the era.
Yeah. I mean, for anybody who's never seen it.
Although it came out after most of the movies that we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah, it was. I wonder if was it like a gold rush where people were rushing to get the
There definitely was,
out.
And Jack Nicholson was a big part of it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And so was Bruce
Dern.
Bruce Dern. He mm-hmm. was in everything.
Mm-hmm. But, so what's the second movie?
Enough about Easy Rider. We all know what that's about. The second movie is The Trip.
Ah, also with Jack Nicholson.
Jack Nicholson wrote it.
And the director...
Roger Corman directed.
Roger Corman,
oh, wow.
Yes. Roger Corman directed one of my picks as well.
This movie is a piece of garbage.
Yeah, well, he was a B-movie guy.
He was.
Is yeah. a B-movie guy.
This has been considered to be one of those cult classics, though, mm-hmm. even though it was just ripped to shreds by
right.
critics. Lots of projections of colors and swirls.
Kaleidoscope scope.
Yeah, onto Peter Fonda while he's tripping. So that was your indication that he's tripping.
Right.
It's just basically Peter Fonda just sitting there looking at the camera, and you've got this swirl going on.
All these very rudimentary but practical effects.
As a connoisseur of B-movies, and Roger Corman in particular, I can't believe I never heard of that movie before.
The Trip.
Yeah. It's worth watching. He's just to give you a background on the story, Peter Fonda's character... Paul Gross. He's a television commercial director in the midst of a personality crisis. His wife Sally's left him. He seeks the help of his friend John, played by Bruce Dern. He's a self-styled guru.
Uh-huh. Guru.
He's an advocate of LSD. He asks John to be his guide on his first trip.
Mm-hmm.
He takes Paul to a freakout and at his friend Max's place, played by Dennis Hopper.
Uh-huh.
There are several strange scenes where he's transported to a forest where he's surrounded by people in hooded robes. There's a hooded rider. There's a torture chamber and a dwarf. So there's a lot of far out visions in this.
Sounds
thing.
Pretty out there. You might not want to watch it if you're too uptight, man.
Yeah.
Were Jack Nicholson and Dennis Hopper established stars at this time? Was this like
they had Corman's, already done?
Yeah,
they
yeah.
had already done a lot of.
So budget wise, this probably wasn't a quote unquote B movie, despite Corman being there.
I think that during that time period, a lot of big money stars were making movies that
they wanted to make.
Like Jack Nicholson wrote this movie.
Yeah, and it really had that feel too that it was kind of like some friends getting together on a
yes.
few weekends and putting a film together.
Very cool. All right, Joey, you want to go ahead with yours?
Sure. I did a Midnight Double Feature, and I tried to highlight two movies that I think kind of highlight the death of the hippie dream, the mm-hmm. dark side of the counterculture. And the first one is a documentary, actually. It's called It's Gimme Shelter.
Yeah.
Rolling Stones documentary.
By Martin Scorsese?
No? You're thinking of The Last Waltz. Well, this was directed by several different people
in
different segments.
Gotcha.
So Gimme Shelter is about the ill-fated Altamont Music Festival, where the Stones tried to stage a music festival and, a la Woodstock.
And have the Hells Angels run security.
Well, it was fucked before that. Yeah. There's only one road in and out. Logistical nightmare. There's not enough food and water and you know, port-a-johns for everybody.
Got a real bottleneck situation happening.
And they hire the Hells Angels, which they had done in Great Britain earlier in a Hyde Park festival.
And it worked fine.
The British Hells Angels are not the same breed of Hells Angels as the California Hells Angels. And it goes downhill fast. Somebody in the crowd has a gun. The Hells Angels are basically just beating the shit out of people. Yeah. You know, they've got a hard-on for cracking heads and whatnot. There's a scene in it where there's one of the Hells Angels, and they're playing, I think it's Under My Thumb.
Under my thumb.
Which is a deeply misogynist song, if you think about it. But and this Hell's Angel is just, he's just visibly wigging out on acid. And mm-hmm. To me, that's the enduring image of the movie. And you can kind of see, like, the death of innocence, too, in Mick Jagger, when he finds out what happens and they're watching the tapes.
Okay.
So I think that kind of highlights the death of the hippie dream.
Yeah.
Woodstock kind of coming full circle and blowing up in their faces.
Well, I read that after 1968, they actually had a funeral for the Summer of Love. Like, they held an actual funeral for the concept.
Well, it was a beautiful but deeply flawed.
I don't mean they as in the Rolling Stones. I mean they as in, like, the hippies in Haight-Ashbury. Mm-hmm.
And the other film that I have as its kind of spiritual sibling is, for 1972, is John Waters and it's Pink Flamingos.
Okay, I've never seen Pink Flamingos. Tell me what the
Okay,
is
so
about.
Pink Flamingos is, John Waters had found his muse in Divine,
who
is
okay.
a very large, like a 300-pound transvestite, basically.
Wow.
And she plays, I forget the character's name, but she's been... voted by a tabloid as the filthiest person alive.
Okay.
And comes by this title very honestly. And then
she owns it.
Yeah, she owns it. And then in comes, and she's content to sort of be as she is, and in comes a married couple who are engaged in all kind of dirty things. They kidnap women, force them to have babies, which they then sell to lesbian couples.
And they're
just all around terrible people. And Divine's character... takes umbrage at the fact that someone else is now the filthiest person in the world and sets out to regain the title.
She wants that belt back.
It's not a great movie. It's one that will probably leave you with a sick feeling in your stomach when you watch it, but it's an experience.
Let me ask you this. What does it have to do with lawn ornaments?
The pink flamingos are just sort of a symbol of trashiness.
Okay. All right. Much like tater tots.
Oh, don't get me started on my tater tot rant. That's for another episode. Maybe we'll do that at the end. But this is a movie that features, among other things, there's the famous scene at the end where Divine eats a very real, very fresh dog turd.
Oh, wow.
On camera.
That is counterculture.
Yeah, she performs oral sex on camera to the character who's playing her son.
I thought you were going to say the dog.
There's a circus performer in the movie who goes by the name of the Singing Asshole. And it is a
portrayed by
performer who sings Papa Umauma with his anus, as you would speak. It got XXX rating when it came out. And like I said, this is like the pushing of that whole counterculture mm-hmm. thing too far.
And John Waters is still around.
Oh, yeah. And he's still making slightly more tasteful films.
Could it get more tasteful than that?
I'll talk about this when I talk about the other two movies. But the hippie movement, part of it was just kind of throwing off the shackles of uh-huh. Puritanism and Victorian ideals. Which I think is healthy for us to do. But then this is uh-huh. just an idea of it going way too far.
Okay, to the extreme.
Yeah.
So gotcha.
That's my midnight double feature.
Cool. I like it. All right, so I've got a couple here that are slightly related tangentially to the ones that you picked, Sean. They're not the same movies, but they are in a similar vein, including directors. So the first one is called Gas, and it's spelled GA-S-S-S. It's also known as It Became Necessary to Destroy the World in Order to Save It. And it's from 1970. And basically, there's this huge gas leak, and it kills everyone over the age of 25. And
targeted gas.
Yeah, when the conservatives... No, it's an accident. It's a military accident, quote-unquote. When the conservatives take over Texas, a group of hippies take off for a New Mexico commune. It's actually at Acoma, the Acoma Pueblo in New Mexico, which is a very cool place if you ever are traveling in the Southwest. The soundtrack is by Country Joe and the Fish, and also it features a very early performance from... Talia Shire, but she was billed as Talia Coppola at the time. There's a scene where they run into Edgar Allan Poe on the way. Let's look at a little bit more information. They discover a Gestapo-like police force will be running Dallas, and they flee into the country. Their car is stolen by some cowboys.
What year was this again?
In 1970. Wow. They meet Edgar Allan Poe, who drives around on a motorbike with a girl on the back. They have an encounter with some bikers who play golf. They attend a dance where AM radio is performing and passes on a message from God, and eventually God intervenes, and two of the characters are reunited with all their friends, and there's a big party where everyone gets along. So this one ends with a happy ending, which is pretty cool. I didn't mention it's directed by Roger Corman.
There we go.
It's got a 19% on Rotten Tomatoes. Not too good. But I did watch it, and it's entertaining for what it is. It's kind of like I think my official review was Roger Corman's attempt at a post-apocalyptic counterculture movie. And then the second one is starring Jack Nicholson, and it's called Psych Out from 1968. He did it right after The Trip. Mm-hmm. Right after The Trip and right before Easy Rider. So he was doing a bunch of these hippie roles at the time. It's directed by Richard Rush, who did some crazy stuff. And the only thing that's coming to my mind right now is a movie called Color of Night with Bruce Willis in the 90s. It was like a really bad erotic thriller.
Vaguely remember this.
Yeah, and with like a multiple personality chick. Are you pulling up?
Yeah, I'll
Rush?
Look
cool.
Up, yeah.
So
this sounds like a Skinamax movie.
It does have. Oh wait. Color of Night or Psych Out? Psych Out is about a deaf girl who goes to San Francisco to find her brother, who's called the Seeker, and he's played by Bruce Dern. And they basically Jack Nicholson is a hippie named Stoney. And he's got a band, and he's got these two friends, and the deaf hippie girl comes to... She's not really a hippie, but she's trying to fit in with the hippie crowd. Mm. And she comes there, and she doesn't have any place to stay, so they take her in. And, of course, there's a transpiring relationship between Jack Nicholson and the deaf girl. There's definitely some social things that would not fly today. Like, in a lot of these movies from this era, there's some things like in one of the ones we're going to talk about later, Peter Sellers uses the word dyke very freely.
This is casual. There's a lot of casual sexism too. And it's funny that like one of my kind of beefs, and I lean left, but one of my beefs with this whole era is that women's liberation became just like a way to further sexualize women in some ways. Uh-huh. And that I think gets played up in one of these movies at least.
Okay, so the other movie that I was thinking of, directed by Richard Rush, is a movie called Hell's Angels on Wheels, speaking of Hell's Angels, and I'm pretty sure it also starred...
It's like everything is interconnected.
Jack Nicholson.
Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, it's like there's some sort of cosmic connection between all these movies, you guys. I'm feeling some really good energy in the room. Will that do it for the Midnight Double Feature?
Yes. I smell a Roger Corman episode.
Yeah. Ooh, we should do that. Yeah. Maybe on his birthday. We've got to figure out when his birthday is. All right, so that brings us to our feature segment, which is the recast. And the first one we're going to do is the worst of the two, I think.
By a country mile.
It's called I Love You, Alice B. Toklas from 1968. And it was directed by a guy named... High Averback, which is kind of funny that his name is High, and we just did the Nicolas Cage episode where his character in Raising Arizona is
and everybody in the movie's High.
Yeah, they are quite high. This one only has a 17% on Rotten Tomatoes, but it's probably
about
pretty accurate.
That's too high.
They earn every percentile.
So, Hi Averback started out as a radio DJ and later moved into TV and film, eventually becoming a director after his acting career. But he also narrated a movie called The Story of Life, which was a sex ed film that they showed to high schoolers in 1948. In 1948. And it had live action sequences, but also animated sequences by a Disney animator.
Wow. This has got to be glorious.
And 62 minutes long. So it took the whole class.
Turns out it's not hot at all, there, you guys.
So we've got this absurd story of Alice B. Toklas, I love you. Before we get into the plot of the movie, let's talk about the reference that the title comes from.
Alice B. Toklas was Gertrude Stein's life partner. They were together for most of their adult lives, 25 years. Gertrude Stein, American expatriate, writer, modernist, icon. And I have here in my hands, I actually checked this out this week, which I'd never read before. It's called The Autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, but it's actually a memoir that Gertrude Stein wrote about herself in the voice of her lover slash cook slash personal assistant, Alice B. Toklas.
Okay.
And they were a lesbian couple long before that was accepted, obviously, in the 20s in Paris. And Toklas kind of has a sad life because she comes across in this book, and again, this is Gertrude Stein writing Alice B. Toklas' voice, as kind of a wallflower who's enamored by the geniuses around her. Stein was in constant company with Picasso and Matisse and whatnot. And she outlived Gertrude Stein, and Stein had collected a lot of now valuable paintings, Picassos and whatnot. And when Toklas was away on vacation, Gertrude Stein's family came in, basically stole all of that stuff from her because their relationship obviously had no legal standing at the time. So she's kind of a sad figure in some ways, a literary figure in her own right. She did write other things other than that cookbook, which is
the reference led to this title. Movie. Yeah.
But I just, when I was watching this movie, I just felt so bad for Alice B. Toklas because her life as a literary figure and as Gertrude Stein's partner basically amounted to being nothing other than
Gertrude Stein's.
Well, she was just Gertrude Stein's
wife,
friend, or wife, as it were. But then after her death, she just became, her name became synonymous with like lame hippie lingo for pot brownies.
Yeah.
And this silly ass movie, which is a pretty shitty
more
legacy.
Like, more like
mama.
Alice B. Tokemore, right?
Yeah. And in the film when her name is Nancy.
Yes.
Someone asked her, who was Alice B. Toklas? And she says, oh, she wrote this groovy cookbook.
Right.
No.
Peter Sellers' character does say, Gertrude Stein's friend.
Yeah, to explain it to her mother. And also, she was committed to song in that. Can we sing lyrics without...
Oh, yeah. Okay. Big time.
I love you, Alice B. Toklas.
Yes, that song was ridiculous.
You, and repeated.
Ridiculous.
So does Gertrude Stein.
Yeah. Very unintentionally funny. I think they were trying to be funny, but it came off kind of
funny in the wrong ways. You're laughing at the movie rather than laughing with it, if you're laughing at all.
Right. Yeah. So the movie itself came out in 1968, and the main character is a guy named Harold Fine. He's an attorney, and it says he's forced into setting a wedding date with his secretary slash fiance. You're not supposed to date your secretary, Harold. Joyce, who we're not going to recast because she's a pretty minor character in the movie, I think.
She basically shows up to get stood up at the altar twice.
Right. Because of a fender bender, he ends up driving a hippie vehicle to a funeral. At the funeral of his family's butcher, he encounters his brother, Herbie, who's a hippie who lives at Venice Beach. And Herbie's girlfriend...
Herbie's a poser. He's
I'm wearing my Hopi funeral garb.
Yeah, that was awful. It was painful.
Now, Herbie's girlfriend is the flower power hippie girl, Nancy. She was played by Lee Taylor Young, and she takes a liking to Harold. She is quite... quite attractive. That's true. I think I wrote down bongos because she brings the best bongos to the drum circle.
Yes.
And so basically he, upon encountering this girl and unknowingly eating the Tokeless brownies with his parents, he falls in love with her and changes his entire life.
Man. He goes all in.
Yeah, I called him Mr. Identity Crisis.
Yes.
Because he does not know who he is. And so what's the time span between when we see him clean cut and when he's all
they don't really establish that.
Yeah,
at all.
I was wondering. I was like, what the hell happened?
And how does his hair grows?
Yeah,
it's very long. It's a wig, but it looks like at least 2 years has passed.
Yeah, so there has to be a time spent there. Enough time where he gets fed up and realizes that he's just as unsatisfied with the free love hippie lifestyle as he was with his square attorney lifestyle. All right, and so the three roles are Harold Fine, portrayed by Peter Sellers, the role of Nancy, portrayed by Lee Taylor Young, a.k.a. Bongos, and then the awkward cast name of Mother, just Mother in quotes. They never refer to her by name. She's always Mom or Mother, played by Joe Van Fleet. So the first role, Peter Sellers, Harold Fine, he was 43 at the time.
Yeah.
Playing 35, though.
Ooh, he was 43.
He was 43, and Joe Van Fleet was 54, so she was 11 years old when she had him.
But he was playing
at
35. There's a point where they get pulled over by the police and he has to show his ID.
Yeah.
And the cop says, "Oh, you're 35." He says, "Yes, I'm 35.
Pull your hair back.
Right, yeah. Right. So
how is it that Peter Sellers is in this movie? This motherfucker was in like Doctor Strangelove
and Pink Panther. Yeah. He did a lot of like racist stuff too. Like he's got this pseudo Chinese character. He does Chinese face, yellow face, I guess you could say. But it's very offensive. But he is a very established comedic personality and has done some very good things. The role of Harold Fine was not one of his best.
Really?
But who wants to go first with Mr. Identity Crisis?
I'll take it. Well, let me talk about what I'm going to do with it. This movie, you know, I've established that what I like to do is come in and really chop them up and, like, do not new things with them. Mm-hmm. This one, I was struggling.
Not with the effort.
Yeah. So the only thing that I think you would do if you hypothetically redid this movie, which you should never do, anyone should never do.
Just leave it alone.
This one especially. I mean, I know we're against rehash culture.
Such a waste of resources.
One, yeah, like, write a movie. You literally couldn't do a whole lot worse.
Maybe do it as a comic book.
Well, I think you just go like full on weed comedy with it. You know what I mean?
Gotcha.
Just a send up of everything. So as the Harold Fine character, I didn't realize that Peter Sellers was that old in this. So this is going to be a little younger. This is an actor that our listeners will recognize as McLovin. This is Christopher Mintz-Plasse.
Yeah.
And again, we're just going to go total comedy with this.
Kick-Ass. He's in Kick-Ass. He's the bad guy in Kick-Ass, right?
Yeah.
Red Mist.
And he playing essentially sort of a mama's boy kind of character who gets drawn out of his shell by weed brownies
nice.
And the sex,
You can't forget the free love, man. All right. Any other further notes on that? Mm-hmm. Your pick?
I'm done.
All right, Sean?
I started out with one pick and then I had a vision.
I changed mine too.
I had a vision this morning.
Yeah.
I went with someone who is now 37 years old.
Okay.
And he's played both the uptight, awkward character, but he's also played the pretty cool and relaxed and with it guy. Everyone loved him in Rushmore. Everyone loved him in Darjeeling Limited.
Yes.
Great. And Scott Pilgrim.
Oh, yeah.
Jason Schwartzman.
He's a Coppola, too.
Yeah.
He's a Coppola nephew. That's awesome.
And this is also the character and his mother, their Jewish heritage is present in the script.
Yeah, they talk about that. There were some words in the description that I didn't understand. At the chupa?
The chupa.
Chupa?
Yes.
What is that?
That's the canopy under which they uh, the wedding vows are exchanged.
Okay.
Yeah, Jewish wedding.
I deleted it because I didn't know what it meant. So that's no disrespect to any of the Jewish traditions. Okay, that's your guy?
That's my guy.
All right, so I also changed my... I originally, just watching the movie, I was like, who could I do? And I went with John Cusack. And I was like, I like John Cusack. He can play kind of a straight-edge guy, but he also recently played the Brian Wilson character in the biopic about Brian Wilson.
Okay.
But I didn't go with him. I was like, wait a minute. No. He's not it. Instead, I went with somebody who could play very awkward. His name is Thomas Middleditch.
Very nice.
Yeah, he's on Silicon Valley. He's also he's in a really good indie movie called Joshy. He's in a ton of really good stuff. He can be very funny, but also has that kind of awkwardness, which I think Peter Sellers came across with a little bit in this.
I agree.
Especially with his, like, uncomfortableness in almost every situation. Okay, so next up, the next role, we've got the role of Nancy, who was played by Lee Taylor Young. Now, Lee Taylor Young was a cutie. She was only 23 at the time. There's no way she would have been interested in Peter Sellers' 43-year-old ass. But
yeah, Pink Panther fetish.
She also had a very fake-looking butterfly tattoo on her leg. Like, you could see it glint in the light, and you could, like, see the edge of the adhesive. Yes. But it was just a subtext to... or a precursor for him to go down on her, basically,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So, Lee Taylor Young... I'm going to go first with this one because I went last on the last two. Mm-hmm. My pick is somebody who you would know more from music, although she has done some acting, not only in her own videos, but also in a couple of short films. She's in a short film called Tropico, where she plays Eve and, I think, Mary Magdalene. She's also in another short film called Poolside, and people either love her or hate her. They're very polarized on this person. But I love her, and her name is Lana Del Rey.
Oh, yeah, I can see that.
Mm-hmm. Lana Del Rey in the role of Nancy the Flower Child in the remake, the unnecessary, for more than one reason, remake of I Love You, Alice B. Toklas. All right, so who's next? Joey?
I have for this role of Nancy, I have Emma Stone.
Ooh, we love Emma Stone.
Yeah, I don't really have a whole lot to say about that casting because this character essentially, I mean, doesn't do a whole lot in the movie. She's basically a foil to...
Yeah,
she's a catalyst,
she's
basically.
Eye candy, and she's also... the catalyst, things that set the plot, the very limited plot in motion.
And she has some kind of preordained chemistry with the McLovin, Christopher Mintz-Plasse.
How so?
She was in Superbad with him, correct?
Cast members.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They're both in Superbad. Okay, yeah. Gotcha.
So
gotcha.
A little bit of built-in chemistry.
I was getting confused because I said super instead of kick-ass, and then I was thinking, never mind. You're right. They do have preordained connections there. Okay. Sean, who do you have?
I'm like Joey. There really isn't much you can do with this movie, and so I decided that if I have to watch this movie, I want to watch somebody playing that part that I just want to see on camera.
Uh-huh.
So I went with somebody who has been in the Star Wars.
The Star Wars,
and she was also
Carrie Fisher's dead. Dude.
No,
rest in peace.
And she was most recently in the Murder on the Orient Express. She's age appropriate. I went with Daisy Ridley.
Daisy Ridley, yeah, she's very good.
Total sidebar here. Has anyone seen the Orient Express?
I have.
Is it?
I had never seen the original.
Okay.
Nor had I read the book.
I have read the book. Eons ago.
So that being said, I enjoyed it. I like all of the actors in it. I didn't know how it ends, so it was like I kind
of... Is there like a new like time travel twist to it somehow? Okay,
not at all. Nope. All right, so the third and final role that we're going to recast in this tire fire of a movie is the role of Mother.
Mother!
Mother! Oh, man. She was portrayed by Jo Van Fleet, who was 53 at the time, and I believe that, Sean, it's your turn to go first.
Sure. Keeping with my casting of Schwartzman, I went with someone who is now, I think she's like 66-ish, and she's a powerhouse. She's been in a ton of stuff, and she's still going strong. Everyone liked her in the Addams Family as Morticia Addams. Yes. I went with Angelica Houston.
Also in Lonesome Dove.
Yep.
She's Augustus McCrae's long-lost love.
She's been in so
another
much.
Another thing.
Good.
Connection, man.
Yeah.
So if anybody can make this movie good, she can.
Oh, she's amazing. She was really, really good in both Royal Tenenbaums and The Life Aquatic.
Yes.
She's kind of a... a staple choice in casting for that particular director. So yeah, I like your Angelica Houston pick. My pick is way better though, because she looks exactly like her and she's really funny and we haven't seen her in a while, but I know she can still do stuff because she's made some appearances. I went with Brett Butler. You guys.
Oh, cool.
Brett Butler. Do you remember her from Grace Under Fire?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Do you remember what her last name was on Grace Under Fire? Because I didn't until I saw it in, like, credits today. Her name was Grace Kelly on the show. Like, come on. Come up with a different Grace. I guess maybe
they're
her character
ironic.
Was supposed to have been named after Princess Grace.
Yeah.
But I was looking at Brett Butler's, not Rhett Butler, but Brett Butler's filmography, and she did... 3 appearances on different sitcoms as the character Grace Kelly. But yeah, she's a dead ringer, especially at this age. She's currently 59 now, so she's a little bit older than the original actress, but she could be the perfect age for the mother of Thomas Middleditch in this terrible remake. So do we have... We got one more.
Yeah, I went with someone who is probably more in line to be Christopher Mintz Plasse's. Let's just call him McLovin, because to me he's totally typecast
McLovin.
For the rest of his life. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like Leonard Nimoy is always going to be Spock.
Yep.
This kid's always going to be
rest
McLovin.
Rest in peace, Leonard Nimoy.
Fran Drescher.
Oh.
Probably more aligned to be his grandmother, as I said, but you know,
haven't heard from her in a while.
Megan is grandma in the movie, or she can play younger, either
Speaking of 90s sitcom stars.
Yeah, and that voice, I can really see that voice being overbearing.
Especially after she
mother.
Eats the brownies.
Oh, God, yeah.
I prefer to think of her as Chandler Bing's girlfriend, annoying girlfriend on Friends. Chandler Bing!
This is one of those times when I feel as if I'm missing out on references because I never really watched Friends.
You didn't watch Friends?
I've seen it, but I wasn't.
Okay.
You know, I wasn't a completionist.
Gotcha. Well, I, at the time, lived in New Mexico and only could catch episodes here and there, but then later probably went back and filled in the gaps. All right. So are we satisfied with our recasting of I Love You, Alice B. Toklas? Really awkward title, too.
I just want to say, when we remake this movie, we're changing the fucking title.
Yeah. What are we going to call it? Sticky Icky Gooey Brownies.
Sticky Icky.
Yeah. I don't think there is a movie called Sticky Icky. On that very academic note, we are going to go into our intermission. All right, Cinema Chop Shoppers, this is your host Travis, just chiming in here at the intermission to remind you to please rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. We appreciate the feedback, and any review is a good review. Also, you can get in touch with us on Twitter. We are at Cinema Chop Shop on Twitter.
We're on Facebook. It's facebook.com/cinemachopshop. And our email address is cinemachopshop@gmail.com. If you want to send us an email, give us some suggestions for themes for future episodes. I have about a year's worth planned out, but you're more than welcome to offer advice, and I'm open to suggestions as well. And as always, thank you for listening, and remember to watch, chop, retrofit.
Coasters for a reason.
Okay, you can go ahead.
All right, so welcome back from the intermission. We appreciate you having a little bit of patience there and bearing with us while we regroup. But we kind of spaced on something.
We spaced out, man.
We spaced out earlier. We were just grooving on this trip, and we forgot to mention how we felt about the fake energy drinks, the homemade, locally sourced energy drinks, farm to table, guys. What did you guys think of them?
Nobody drinks La Croix for its to taste. You drink it for the hipster cachet.
I kind of like the grapefruit one.
I like the grapefruit. Yeah.
Yeah.
The energy drink actually kind of improved the taste.
Okay, the Mio?
Yeah.
Gotcha, okay. Now, there were two different ones. There was a berry and then a cran raspberry. Did you guys notice a difference, or did the Mio just overpower both
of them?
I like
the berry one better.
Okay, but, the nondescript generic berry.
But I thought they were both good.
It's a berry. All right, so we're gonna jump right ahead to where we should be at, which is our beer check-in. If you want to toast us or check in the beers or check out what we're checking in, you can do so on Untappd. That's untappd.com, and we are Cinema Chop Shop on Untappd. The first beer that we are going to check in is pretty groovy. It's by Three Heads Brewing, which is out of Rochester, New York. And it's got a hippie with a pot belly and a guitar and four arms, like a Vishnu type thing. He's meditating. He's wearing his tie-dye. And it's called The Kind India Pale Ale, a reference that is lost on no one. What do you guys think of it? Sean, honest opinion.
You want me to go first? I haven't had this in a while, and I didn't like it the first time.
Okay.
I don't like it now. It tastes like a beer infused with lawnmower clippings.
Oh, so it tastes like grass, man.
Very grassy, man.
Ass, grass, or gas. Nobody rides for free, man. All right, Joey, thoughts?
One of the many reasons that I like guesting on this podcast is that I get to drink free beer.
Yep. It's not free, but...
Well, you know, I didn't pay for it.
It's free to him.
I'll bring one next time.
We can share what we got of yours, because we done shared all of mine.
And as I mentioned last week, I've been a whiskey drinker for most of my life, and I'm recently trying to kind of develop my beer palate.
Okay.
And so this, to me, I see what Sean's saying, tastes like that which I don't particularly care for with IPAs.
Okay.
I'm kind of
a little bit
about.
Too resinous, maybe?
Very bitter.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I like it. Screw you guys.
That's fine. You're entitled.
To each their own. And also, it's very on theme with our episode
today.
You
couldn't ask for a better.
Right. And then the next one, also kind of on theme. Go ahead and crack that open for the mic.
This one comes from Percosi, Pennsylvania, from a friend of the podcast, Sonny. He gave me this over the Christmas break. It's called Special Cookie. It's an imperial spiced brown ale.
How special are they?
I don't know. It's cardamom, brown sugar, cinnamon, ginger, and vanilla.
Okay.
So
I'm just going to rinse my glass a little bit here with the water.
Something I should taste.
Seems like something made by Alice B. Toklas.
Yeah.
I love you, Alice B. Toklas. The song never gets old. Never.
At the Mickey Finns today, they were using an air horn, and that's what Holt said. He's like, never gets old.
This is very heavy on the cardamom.
Okay, now cardamom is a spice, right?
Yes.
What would I taste that in?
Indian food.
Indian food. Okay. I wish we had more Indian food around here. All right, I'm gonna taste it. Okay.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's That reminds me of like a Thanksgiving pie.
It reminds me of like a
one of those really expensive ginger snaps, like not just not the kind you get in the box, but like
the fancy tray. You know, that's what I get out of this, and I think that's what they're shooting for.
So this tastes just like Trader Joe's cookie butter.
Yes. Oh, I just said yes. Trader Joe's. Awesome.
Oh, wow. Smells good.
So the next thing that we're going to talk about, everybody's good on talking about beer, is my 2018 movie marathon. I haven't changed it from 2017 on the paper, but it is now 2018. It is the 12th day of the year. It's really easy to remember what day of the year it is this time of year because it's the 12th day of January. But I have seen, I've got 14 on here, but I've actually seen 15. 16 if you count Psych Out. So we will. So 16. But I'm just going to talk about a few of them. Number 8, starting where we left off last week, was a movie called Mark Felt. It's not about Marco's masturbation habits. It's actually about Deep Throat and the Nixon.
Oh, so it is.
Yeah. Yes. it's about the... Oh, also, happy birthday shout out to Marco. We're celebrating his birthday tonight as well. It's about Deep Throat and the Watergate thing and the agent who was the informant but didn't admit so until much, much later, played by Liam Neeson. And what was my official review? Mark Felt, the man who brought down the White House, all the inside dirt on the Watergate scandal, Deep Throat, and the FB fucking eye. Next is a true crime documentary that I cannot believe I had never seen. It's another Errol Morris joint, which I have to go back and try again on Wormwood because I didn't realize that it's Errol Morris. And I also didn't realize it was a documentary until I started watching
Docudrama.
Okay, yeah. So the movie's called The Thin Blue Line from 1988. It's an amazing documentary in which he actually, like, catches somebody on tape admitting to crimes and admitting to perjury. Amazing and innovative true crime documentary from director Errol Morris. Can't believe I'm just seeing this. All right, next we've got Dawson City, Frozen Time. This is a archival footage documentary. It comes from Canada, Dawson City in the Yukon Territory, right?
Too cold.
Too cold. number 10, Dawson City, Frozen Time from 2016. In 1978, in Canada, a long-lost collection of 533 nitrate film prints from the early 1900s were discovered buried under a hockey rink in a former Klondike Gold Rush town. Yeah, you guys.
Wow.
I said Canada and hockey and movies, all in the same thing. All right, next, speaking of...
What are these pictures of?
Pictures what?
The...
They're movies. Nitrate film canisters. They're movies.
But what's on them?
All kinds of things. The Gold Rush, basically. Mostly
like archival documentary footage.
Yes.
Type.
Yes. Okay. But they was previously undiscovered. They were buried underneath a hockey rink. They discovered them. They had previously not been seen. It's amazing. Next one, not so amazing. I mean, it is. It's visually amazing. If you don't know that it's fake, it's called Treasures of the Wreck of the Unbelievable. And it is a documentary about a massive Damien Hirst exhibition in Venice purporting to present ancient treasures from a sunken Greek ship. So it's really weird. Like, the documentary presents it like it's real, too. But it's not. It's Damien Hirst.
Fake
and he's like, it is. It's a huge exhibition, too. And, like, hundreds of thousands of people are going to see it. And only a portion of them realize that it's just Damien Hirst being Damien Hirst. I already talked about Alice B. Toklas. Finally, the last one I'm going to mention today is The Art of Listening. It's a documentary that's on Netflix, and it's all about music and the journey that music takes to reach the listener's ear. From intent of an instrument maker and composer to the producers and engineers who capture and preserve an artist's voice. That wasn't my description. Somebody else wrote that. All right, so that will do it for the 2018 movie marathon for today. I'm like four ahead of the game. Sean was talking about getting in on the game.
Yeah, I've seen quite a few so far, yeah. So I might jot them down.
Just as long as you check them in on Twitter with the hashtag 2018 Movie Marathon, so I can keep up with your
status.
Shout
out to Letterboxd, too, yeah, which Letterboxd I never heard of shit, until right? I saw your 17 of 17.
Yes.
It really satisfies my sick need to document and uh-huh. organize yeah. and categorize.
It's an OCD person's paradise.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And they've got the pictures, and you can see other people's reviews yeah. and stuff. Very cool. All right, so that will bring us to the second part of our feature segment. It's the recast continued, and the movie that we're talking about has a much higher rating than Alice B. Toklas. It's still not a great movie. It's got a 65... There's parts of it that are...
It has the potential. It's okay. A flawed movie, but yeah. it's there's something there with this one.
Also from 1968, it's called Wild in the Streets, and it was directed by Barry Scheer. I don't know much more about the director, but the basic premise is that a prototypical 60s rock star named Max Frost lends his backing to a Senate candidate, and the Senate candidate wants to give 18-year-olds the vote. But Max Frost takes things a step further than expected.
14 or fight.
14 or fight. Inspired by their hero's words, Max fans pressure their leaders into extending the vote to citizens as young as 15. Max and his followers capitalize on their might and bringing new issues to the fore, but drunk on power, they soon take generational warfare to terrible extremes.
And they dose Congress.
They do.
They do.
Yeah. Although, would we even know? We be able to tell?
I sent Travis and Andrew a message on Monday, and I said, you know, I hate you for making me watch these movies. But
you said, oh, the groans.
Oh, the groans. But dosing Congress, that yeah. was
I think
was
I like this one a lot more than y'all did.
I liked it better than Alice B. Toklas.
I like it.
I will say this movie, I think, could benefit from a remake.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. That was
I think it speaks to like a millennial cultural generation yeah. kind of thing.
Yeah. And so it would work as a remake, but we are not advocating that.
No,
that
not
happens.
Advocating.
You could do it in the Trump era. I mean,
oh, big time. There's a lot of parallels.
That field is fallow right yes. now, and it's yeah.
Her womb was a barren place. So we've got four roles to recast in this movie. We've got the role of Max Frost, who was portrayed by Christopher Jones. We've got I've got a better guy. We've got Senator Fergus, who was played by Hal Holbrook.
Who was never young. I mean,
ever.
He came out of the womb at like 40.
He was born an old man. Yeah. We've also got the girlfriend to Max Frost, also a member of his band, Sally Leroy, played by Diane Varsi. Am I saying that mm-hmm. right? Varsi? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who won the role based on her ability to act stoned and fall off of a water fountain into the pool. Yeah.
In
this film.
Oh, in this movie. Okay, yeah. I thought you meant she got it.
She really sold the fall. Yeah.
She probably was really stoned.
Yeah.
And then finally, probably my favorite role that we're going to recast is an early Richard Pryor performance. He was only 28 at the time as Stanley X. He's the drummer for the band. And yeah, those are the four. So who wants to go first on Max Frost?
Sean, you had the radical idea for the...
Okay,
the
I'll go. I'm not thrilled with my pick, but I've got better ones, but I'll go with this first one. Needing to be musically inclined and musically uh-huh. talented, I picked someone who was most recently in the new Jumanji remake.
Uh-huh.
But everyone probably knows him from his... Is it Disney? He was one of the Jonas Brothers. It's Nick Jonas.
Nick Jonas. Okay. All right.
He's my Max Frost.
He done acting?
He was in Jumanji.
He
was in. He's been in some other stuff.
Okay. I
mean, but yeah, mostly it's the Jonas Brothers antics. But
Did you recast all of the Jonas Brothers as the band?
Shush.
That was a premonition.
I went with Hanson, so it's like we're on theme.
Mm-bop. We need more singing on the show. All right.
I think
so,
we need less singing. It's so different from me.
I'll go next with mine. I went with a guy who is recognizable, but you don't quite know where you know him from. His name's Michael Angerano, or Angerano. He was the little version of William in Almost Famous. He's also in Lords of Dogtown. He's in the Stanford Prison Experiment. And that's my guy.
Yeah, I can
right
dig
there.
It. I can dig it.
Him?
I can dig it, man.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Pretty good. All right, so that is my pick for Max Frost, our agitator.
Okay, before I recast the role of Max Frost, let me just say I'm with Sean. I think this movie actually could handle. I'm not advocating it as right. I was openly with Raising Arizona, which I'm still. If anybody
no,
wants
they,
to make
we
that
got some
happen,
good feedback on that. Actually,
we can do that. This one could handle a remake, and it maybe even deserves a remake because it has the potential, but is deeply flawed. One of the flaws in this movie is that Max Frost, who's supposed to be this very charismatic, very messianic kind of figure.
He's also a drug dealer and a fucking douchebag.
Well, he's like, and he's supposed to be like the Pied Piper of the youth, uh-huh. And the actor playing him, I just don't buy it. He's just not very charismatic.
Christopher Jones. I mean, what else has he done?
He just doesn't. And the way he plays the character, I don't buy that anyone's like following. He's not David Bowie, who people are, So
he's more David Cassidy than David Bowie.
Yeah. And I went with someone who I think could sell that kind of Charlie Manson-like, messianic kind of thing. And that is Evan Peters.
Evan Peters from American
like
Horror, Story.
Horror Story.
We like Evan on the show.
Yeah.
He's kind of kooky in real life.
He is.
He's played sort of off-kilter, messianic kind of characters within the universe of that show. And my wife is hot for him.
Okay.
So it will make her happy.
Nice.
And that's what I went with.
Very cool.
I want to say, too, this movie, I don't think that this movie is so much a counterculture movie.
Okay.
Both of these movies. Like, Alice B. Toklas is a counterculture movie in that it's about the counterculture.
Uh-huh. But it's also kind of satirical.
It's not really a product of the counterculture.
Okay.
It was made outside of the counterculture for
outside looking in.
And this movie is more like a horror film for people who are really freaked out by the idea of the counterculture and its obsession with, among other things, youth.
So the there was a poster for this movie, and it said, it could happen here or it could happen now or something. Mm-hmm. So they very much were playing up that element of fear.
This is actually more, you could argue that this is, instead of a counterculture movie, this is a very, very, very establishment movie.
Oh, okay.
Because it's sort of poking fun at.
Yes,
and
I caught that too.
And making people angry at and scared of the counterculture and its association like with youth and everything.
So
I think you have to kind of play that up. And if you do this, redo this in the Trump era, which, again, we're not advocating that, but you could really play that up in ways.
Big time.
Yeah.
It's more important now than it's ever been, you guys.
What a shithole, man.
What a shithole. All right, so have we all gone on Max Frost? Next up, we've got Hal Holbrook as Senator Fergus, and I was just looking at him and also trying to kind of think of somebody who looks kind of like a politician, you know? And I went with somebody who I really admire as an actor, but also who played John F. Kennedy recently on the miniseries The Kennedys, and my pick is Greg Kinnear. Greg Kinnear. Now, the only drawback to having Greg Kinnear in this role is he's a little bit too likable.
Yeah.
Greg Kinnear, his affability might interfere with you.
You're going to have to act this time, Greg Kinnear.
Yeah. No, he's a good actor. He's a good actor. My Greg Kinnear is my Senator Fergus. He is a little bit older than Hal Holbrook was at the time, but he looks younger somehow. Greg Kinnear is 54, and Hal Holbrook was only 43 at the time. And that's a screenshot from Hal Holbrook. Doesn't Greg Kinnear look younger than
that's
Hal Holbrook?
That's what clean living will do for you there, folks.
Very clean. God is alive. All right, so Joey?
For Senator Fergus?
Yes.
Hal Holbrook, again, who was never young, is actually one of the bright spots of this movie, his portrayal, mm-hmm. especially when he gets drunk and the alcohol generation, as we all sit around and drink alcohol.
Right.
And so I wanted someone
is NA beer.
Who is could kind of sell that establishment, uh-huh. the man kind of thing. And I went with Bryan Cranston.
Uh-huh.
From Breaking Bad and other things. And he just
talked about him a lot.
Yeah, he's age appropriate. I think he can play right on the borderline between affability and assholishness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And one of the other things that I like about this movie, and again, it's deeply flawed, but the way that the politicians are just totally manipulating and using the mm-hmm. youth vote, they don't give a shit about the... And again, the dark side of the hippie movement and the counterculture kind of comes out in this. But Bryan Cranston can also kind of, I think, show the dark side of of the man and the establishment in this movie. And that's why I cast him as Senator Fergus.
We talked on a recent episode about how he was in his underwear for the entirety of Malcolm in the Middle mm-hmm. and actually got his start as a male model.
Also has memorable underwear scenes in Breaking Bad.
Gas mask and underwear. That's all you need. All right.
Well, we're gonna have to put him in whitey tidies at least once during the rehash of this.
When he's drunk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Perfect. Belligerent with his kids.
Yeah.
Sean?
Yeah. I went with somebody who is who can be likable and completely unlikable. And
okay.
He does it episode In and Out, where he's quite a chameleon.
The movie In and Out?
No. On his regular TV series, The Americans.
Oh.
Plays Philip Jennings. It's Matthew Rhys.
I haven't actually watched the show. Oh, my lovely wife, Michelle, has. Drink.
He's great. He's fantastic.
Is he also the voice of Paddington?
He's not. No, don't pay attention to that. He's been in many other things. He was in The Edge of Love. He was a regular on Brothers and Sisters on ABC.
Oh, okay, yeah. Oh, what's this? Burnt? I love that movie.
With Bradley Cooper. He had a role in that as well. Movie.
Yeah.
I think that he could do that manipulator, politician kind of thing, too, where, it's like, I can be likable when I want to be, but I can be a complete ass and I can beat my kids while I'm drunk.
Mm-hmm. I mean, no, don't do that.
Don't do that. Not the advocating it.
So, that will do it for Senator Fergus. That's enough talk about politicians. And the next role is the girlfriend to Max Frost, his right-hand woman. She was originally portrayed by Diane Varsi, and her character's name was Sally LeRoy. Diane Varsi was 30 at the time, and I think that Joey's going first on this one.
All right, so we did this last week with one of the roles, I think it was in Valley Girl, where we tried to... Or no, actually, it was in the Christmas episode where we decided that Donna Reed's character in It's a Wonderful Life needed a meatier role.
Okay.
This role needs to be meatier.
It does. I love it.
The only thing she really does is fall off of that fountain into the pool, which she totally sells. And then she comes in and she says, "It's just tiger milk." And then she has that ridiculous speech to Congress.
Yes.
So that's basically the only thing she does in the film. I want to kind of play up that, like, shambolic kind of earthy sexiness with her with this role. I want to make her a little bit more in control, and when we redo this one, she's kind of pulling the strings of Max Frost.
She's the puppeteer.
Yeah. And so for this one, I have chosen an actress unless you've seen Amazon's series I Love Dick, which is
with Kevin Bacon.
Yeah, really fucking good, by the way. Her name is India Menuez.
But what's the name of the show?
I Love Dick.
Well, what's the name of the show?
I Love Dick. I Love Dick.
Yeah, she's beautiful. Yeah, she would be really good.
Yeah, and also in this series, she plays a performance artist who really does hyper-sexualized performances, and she spends most of one episode completely full-frontally naked.
All right, I like that. Movie count up to two.
You would probably have to do playing this role in this movie. And again, I'm going to make her not just be naked all the time, but also be kind of pulling the strings behind
the scenes. She is in charge of her own sexuality.
Yeah, and she's not really in the in this movie. She's just even the narrator says, "Sally Leroy, what acid head?" Like that. Mm-hmm. Like he basically says that
as narrated by Morgan Freeman. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So she kind of was a sideshow a little bit.
And also in this movie, she comes in and she has her hair covering her breasts,
mm-hmm.
and everyone's shocked as if she's
pre Blue Lagoon.
Yeah. Again, this movie isn't so much a product of the counterculture as much as it is a product of the establishment commenting on.
Right.
So we're going to subvert that, mm-hmm. and we're going to admit, yeah.
Very nice. All right.
This is my weakest pick.
All right, go ahead.
But I took the role at face value.
I didn't get out in front of it.
Yeah, I didn't try to amp it up at all. This pick has very little in the way of credits other than she was a Victoria's Secret angel.
I'm on board.
From 2013 to 2015, she was on their fashion shows from 2011 to 2014. And she played Eve in Zoolander 2.
Oh.
But I know her from a fucking Squarespace commercial that's at the front of all my YouTube videos because she's always trying to sell me on Squarespace. Super simple way to create beautiful websites that even people with no computer knowledge can do.
Make your space your own.
So Squarespace, if you're listening, we'll take
your money.
We
want that money. Right,
anyway, it's Carly Kloss.
Carly Kloss?
Kloss.
Kloss?
K-L-O-S-S.
Oh.
She's very pretty. Mm-hmm.
She's got a little bit of a Jennifer Beale look to her.
Yeah. I think that, she's a dead ringer for the character, and that's all I was going for.
Okay.
So,
well, my pick, I was thinking about doing the Lana Del Rey for this girl, but I didn't. I switched it to the other girl. Instead, I went with Haley Lou Richardson, who is 22 now, and you would know her from a movie called The Edge of 17 with Hailee Steinfeld.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, she's she was the quirky friend of the more popular friend of Hailee Steinfeld's character in Edge of 17. All right. We got one more?
Yeah.
One more.
The best one.
The best one. It's the role of Stanley X, which obviously is a reference to Malcolm X, a kind of half-handed reference to civil rights and that movement. Richard Pryor was only 28 at the time. He plays the drummer.
In the world of this movie, he'd be in a concentration camp in 2 years.
I love, right? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I love
because
the shots.
He's 28.
I love
all the shots of him from the midsection up, where he looks like he's playing drums, but they never actually show him striking the drums.
Yeah.
Good job there.
Well, I looked it up, and I don't know that Richard Pryor actually has any musical talent. But my pick does have some
Mine
musical
too.
Talent.
I wonder if we got the same person.
I don't think
Mine
we do. Too. Okay, well, Joey, you spoke up first, so go ahead.
Well, I was a little bit surprised that we were recasting this role, and I don't think if it wasn't Richard Pryor, it probably would have been.
We would not have been. If it wasn't Richard Pryor, it would not be discussed right now.
So, one of my pet peeves in movies and TV shows is when people are playing music and they're not really playing, it's piped in.
Like the Monkees.
Yeah. And what I'm going to do is have an actual band playing live, and Evan Peters can sing. He does it in the Freak Show season of...
Yeah,
so he can pull it off. So I want somebody who's a drummer. And this... his name is Antonio Sanchez, and you probably know him as the drummer from Birdman.
Oh, remember, the Michael Keaton movie.
Yeah, Birdman.
It was just constant drums.
Yeah, it's a good movie, but it's not great.
It's like the audio from Whiplash set to Michael Keaton's Midlife Crisis.
Yeah, and I don't know if the score for that movie won an Oscar or was even nominated for it, because I don't...
It may have been nominated, it did not win.
It should have, because it was... Not only was it fucking great, it was very innovative, and dudes out on the street playing the drums as they do those long, long tracking shots.
And I felt like the drumming in that movie, like, escalated the tension.
Oh, yeah, it was the best thing about that. I liked that movie, I got some problems with it.
It wasn't the Tidy Whities?
No.
The Whitey
But so his name's Antonio Sanchez. He's a drummer from that, and he's going to actually play drums when we're playing. And if he can't act, then
Well, he doesn't have to act very much in this movie.
Yeah, it doesn't hold up to a whole lot. Yeah.
No, once again, the only reason that we're recasting this role is because it's fucking Richard Pryor, you guys. All right, so Sean, do you want to go or can
I can go.
All right, go ahead.
This is my favorite pick.
All right, do it.
All right, he played the JV cleaning boy in She's All That in 1999.
What?
I'm sorry, we reached way back for that. He was Bug Wendell in the Gridiron Gang with Dwayne The Rock Johnson in 2006. He played Tyrone in Dirty Grandpa, but I know
just him. Call on Tyrone.
But I know him from one of my favorite TV shows, You Are the Worst. He's Sam Dresden, the rap artist, and he's angry, indignant, but he has a heart of gold.
I can see this guy.
I can see him.
Brandon McHale Smith or Michael Smith?
Brandon Michael Smith is the actor. Yes.
Very cool.
He's great.
You know, I need to step up my game on You're the Worst.
You need to watch it.
Yeah, I've seen like one or two episodes, and what I saw was great. And I've also heard some of those guys on various podcasts, and they're hilarious.
Well, there's a podcast in the show as well.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
All right, guys, I'm about to blow you away. My pick is a actor who hasn't done a lot of stuff, but he was in one of my recent 2017 movie marathon installments, the movie Kicks, that was about shoes.
Yes.
And the kid who has to get his shoes back from some thugs. This guy plays one of his friends. His name is C.J. Wallace. But you might also know him as Chris Wallace Jr., son of Biggie Smalls.
Oh, wow. Shit.
Can you see it now?
Yeah.
Can you see his face? But you could also see him as the drummer in Max Frost's band, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can see it.
We talked about Chris Wallace on a previous episode.
Okay.
All right, cool. So
maybe we should redo this with Max Frost being a rapper.
Ooh, all right. Dr. Dre is Mac. No. Well, Childish Gambino was one of the names that was floating around in my head.
Yes.
Donald Glover, a.k.a.
Which we've used many times.
Yeah, that's why I didn't do it.
Me too.
All right, so.
Well, I have a bonus pick.
Bonus! So, yeah.
Steve Harvey?
This is hard, y'all.
When I saw and I watched the movie before I looked at who we were recasting. And I was kind of shocked that you didn't call Max's mother, Shelley Winters.
Shelley Winters.
I didn't, because she plays
that part with like religious fervor.
So who is your bonus?
I picked someone who would laugh in a director's face if they pitched this movie to her, and it's Meryl Streep.
Oh, okay. For a second, I thought you were going to tie it to the your actor for Max Frost,
Peters. Jessica Lange.
No. Kathy Bates.
She could do it.
Yeah, she could do it.
When Meryl Streep says, fuck you guys, then we'll get Kathy Bates because she's on board.
And
she'd be like, oh, yeah, I'll do that. Yeah, sure.
All right, guys. Are we going long, Andrew? We're doing good? We got one more segment, and we are going to supersede the normal segment, the one that we haven't done in a while, the wild card. And we're going to do the Chop Shopper Challenge. The Chop Shopper Challenge went out on Facebook on Tuesday, I think, right? Did I send it up on Tuesday? Maybe Wednesday.
Yeah.
I tried to put it up a little bit earlier because I think that Facebook is limiting the exposure of posts unless you boost them. So, because you were saying last week that you didn't see the Chop Shopper Challenge until Friday, and I posted it on Wednesday. So anyway, I posted a little bit earlier.
I thought there were more comments than this. Did some get deleted?
Well, there's some that are on my page and some that are on... Yeah, because I reposted it to my page just for like more exposure.
I'll let you run with it then.
So the Chop Shopper Challenge was to recast the two main roles in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, the classic adaptation of Hunter S. Thompson's book. It came out in 1998, and it was directed by Terry Gilliam of Monty Python fame, also a very established avant-garde director in his own right.
Brazil.
Very recently he did the one with Christoph Waltz, the It's like something about a brain. Anyway, he's amazing. He's been trying
also
to make...
Also did the animations in The Wall.
Yes. He's also been trying to make a Don Quixote movie for like 20 years.
I read that that's back on the...
It's coming out. It's definitely going to come out.
But not Johnny Depp's not in it this time around.
No. Speaking of Johnny Depp, he played Raoul Duke, which was a fictionalized version of Hunter S. Thompson's own personality. And the other role is the role of Dr. Gonzo, which was portrayed by Benicio del Toro, but it was based on a real-life person named Oscar Zeta Acosta, who was a major figure in the Chicano movement, and who went missing in, like, 1976, and nobody's ever heard of him. But he was a friend of Hunter S. Thompson's, and so that's who the character of Dr. Gonzo is based on. But... Oscar Acosta was a Mexican-American, an American of Mexican heritage. Benicio del Toro is a Puerto Rican-American. The character of Dr. Gonzo is supposed to be a Samoan. So there's a lot of different things that come into play when you're thinking about recasting that. So who wants to go first?
I'm not recasting.
Oh, you're not recasting it? You just want to hear the listeners' choices?
Yeah.
Okay.
This is their turn.
All right. So, my lovely wife, Michelle.
Drink.
Suggested Dave Franco as the Raoul Duke. Recently did a very good job as the brother of his brother in The Disaster Artist, which is about The Room, which we talked about earlier. Everything's connected, you guys. So, her pick for the role of Dr. Gonzo was a guy named Aidan Turner. Aidan Turner. I looked him up, and I agreed with this pick a little bit more than Dave Franco. Has anybody got a...
I'll look it up. I don't know.
Go for Aidan Turner. Pull him up. And then Holly Tamale, hopeful future guest. She was supposed to be on the bartending/drinking movies. She suggested Leonardo DiCaprio for the role of Raoul Duke, and then also LDP. Lou Diamond Phillips. Lou Diamond Phillips as Dr. Gonzo. Also, Jeremy. Yeah. We'll talk about him on the upcoming Rock and Roll Movies episode.
I promise I will not sing. Next time I'm out.
No,
please. We're
going
to have to ask
your lovely
wife, Michelle, if she means this Aidan Turner.
Or show me the other one.
There's another one who was in Drive.
I think it's the one from Drive.
Okay. Then there's
maybe
your
answer. Not. We'll address it in the Department of Corrections department. All right. Jeremy, who's another guy at the bar I hassled to make a pick, picked Michael Cera for the role of Raoul Duke and a much older... Dr. Gonzo, Cheech Marin. He's got Cheech Marin for the Dr. Gonzo role. Eddie of Crystal and Eddie, says no replacements, which isn't really an entry. I tried to hassle him a little bit more. Hillary says just cast Key and Peele, which is true. You should just cast Key and Peele because we just need more Key and Peele in 2018.
Eventually, we're going to do an episode where it's Key and Peele and the entire in cast
every
of Stranger
role.
Things as the base.
Whoa, the crossover Key and Peele Stranger Things episode. Stranger Key and Peele things. All right, so I'll go ahead and reveal my picks because I participated in this Chop Shopper challenge. And my picks... that's not it. Hold on. We're getting there. All right, so my pick for the role of Raoul Duke is a guy named Frank Delane, mm-hmm. or Delaney. He's 26 now. He's on Fear the Walking Dead.
Yeah.
He looks exactly like Johnny Depp, you guys.
Well, they always called him...
Young Johnny Depp?
Little Johnny Depp whenever I hear reference to the Fear the Walking Dead.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that, but it was just an intuitive pick. And for the role of Dr. Gonzo, as portrayed by Benicio del Toro, I talked about this a little bit ago. The character was supposed to be Samoan. There are very few Samoan actors, and fewer still that could play this role. So I went with a Polynesian person, a Pacific Islander. He's actually from New Zealand. He's of Maori descent, and his name is Panahema Taylor. Panahama Taylor is 28 now, and he, you probably recognize him for his early role in the movie Boy by Taika Waititi. Taika Waititi, who did What We Do in the Shadows, also recently directed Thor Ragnarok. Very prominent New Zealand director who works a lot with Jemaine Clement from Flight of the Conchords. So Panahima Taylor is my Dr. Gonzo. You guys are loving these visual comparisons. I know you are. You're just nodding like, yes, Travis, move it along, move it along. All right, so that will do it, right? Unless you guys have any more comments on Fear and Loathing. It goes without saying that you couldn't recast this. You couldn't cast it any better than Johnny Depp as Hunter S. Thompson, because he went out there and lived with him on his ranch to, like, prepare for the role. They had mushroom pizza together. Like,
he does the same thing that Philip Seymour Hoffman does in the Capote movie, where it's less a performance.
He goes and lives with Truman Capote?
Well, no. I mean, it's less a performance of a character than it is, like, a mimicry of, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So this is a criticism. No, own it.
I don't particularly care for the film.
Interesting.
I have a very complicated relationship with the book Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
It was the first book I ever stole. Sorry, Mom.
That's a book that you should steal.
Mm-hmm. Steal this book.
How do we not talk about Abbie Hoffman steal this movie on the counterculture?
Well, by all means, well, talk about it.
I don't have much to
steal
say
this
about
movie
it.
Is the movie about Steal This Book. Right? Mm-hmm. Steal This Book is the book by Abbie Hoffman.
Or Abbie Kaufman.
Abbie Hoffman came up as Gabby Kaufman.
Yeah. I accidentally said Abbie Hoffman when I meant Gabby Hoffman. Thanks, Andrew. Happy birthday.
Hit the sound effects, yeah. Burr.
All right. So is that going to wrap it up, guys?
That should wrap it up.
All right. We're wrapping it up. And I want to thank the guests. I want to thank Joey Poole for being back.
I love you, Alice B. Toklas.
Very nice. Yeah. We've gotten some really good feedback about your appearances on the show, and we hope to have you back many times. If you can get a hall pass.
I'll work on the hall pass.
We will appreciate it. Do you have anything you want to plug?
Not tonight.
Not tonight. All right. And then Sean, the rabble rouser. You're here.
I'm here.
Give me something rabble rousing.
No.
God damn the man!
Thanks,
Sean. Thanks for saying that.
You're welcome.
I have nothing to plug.
You have nothing to plug?
Except for Seminar Brewing.
Oh, what about the upcoming canning?
Oh, yeah. We're going to do a canning release on the 27th of this month, January, this month. And we'll have
Pixels
back. Citrosity is back in the single hop mosaic, which is something we've had in the tasting room. We're going to can that and release it.
Oh, it's so good. Yeah, we had that on the show.
Yes.
Last week, maybe a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
All right.
I'll plug field work this saison.
Oh, you liked
that,
it.
That's my shit, man.
You liked the field work. Hillary was making some allusions to the name being slightly racist, but it's not that kind of field work.
Oh, that's some
you guys.
Bullshit,
yeah. And then also, we want to wish a happy birthday to Andrew.
Woo!
Andrew, I'm sorry, but I don't even know how old you are. How old are you?
It's a secret.
63. He does have this kind of ageless quality.
Yeah. He will never reveal his actual age.
He's the reverse Hal Holbrook.
He's actually older than any of us. All right. Well, thank you again, Canadian in Your Brain again, and happy birthday. In terms of the podcast itself, please go onto iTunes and rate, review, subscribe. Even if you don't like it, even a tire fire makes the news. You can tweet at us. Tweedledeet. At Cinema Chop Shop on Twitter. And we're also on Facebook. We are facebook.com/Cinema Chop Shop. That's where all of the listener challenges go up, there and Twitter. And then our email address is cinemachopshop@gmail.com. Finally, we are on Untappd. We are Cinema Chop Shop on Untappd. That's untappd.com. And finally, thank you. The listeners, thank you for tuning in and please remember to watch chop retrofit. That was pretty tight.
$128.